Chapter 12.
Gorgonweed, Austin said. That's a new one. Is this stuff as bad as your friend says it is?
It could be, Gamay said. Dr. Osborne is quite concerned. I respect his judgment.
What do you think?
It's cause for worry, but I can't say definitively until we have more evidence from the Lost City.
Gamay had called Austin aboard the Mummichug. She apologized for getting him out of bed, but said she and Paul were en route to the Lost City and wanted to make sure that he knew what they were up to.
Thanks for filling me in. We'd better alert Dick and Rudy, he said, referring to Dirk Pitt, who had succeeded Admiral Sandecker as head of NUMA, and Rudy Gunn, who was in charge of the agency's day-to-day operations. Paul has talked to both of them. NUMA already had some biologists working on the Calerpa problem.
Austin smiled. Why am I not surprised that Dirk is one step ahead of us?
Only half a step. He was unaware of the Lost City connection. He'll be waiting for a report on Paul's dive.
Me too. Wish him luck. Keep in touch. As Austin hung up, the words of T.S. Eliot came to mind. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper.
A soggy whimper at that.
Paul and Gamay could handle the situation, and there was nothing he could do in the meantime, so he busied himself with a stem-to-stern inspection of the Seamobile. Aside from a few dents and scrapes, the vehicle was in better shape than he was, Austin concluded. He sat in the bubble cabin and went through a checklist. Satisfied all systems were working, he picked up two mugs of coffee from the galley, went below, and knocked softly on the door to Skye's stateroom. Recognizing that the Mummichug was a relatively small vessel, the boat's designers had factored in small individual cabins where crew members could enjoy their privacy. Skye was up and dressed. She opened the door immediately and smiled when she saw Austin.
Good morning, he said.
As he handed Skye a steaming mug, he noticed the dark circles under her eyes.
Did you sleep well?
Not very. I kept dreaming I was being smothered under tons of ice.
I have a proven cure for nightmares. How would you like to explore an underwater tomb?
Her face lit up.
How could any woman in her right mind refuse such an enticing offer?
Follow me, then. Our chariot waits without.
With Austin and Skye on board, the submersible was lowered into the water between the catamaran's twin hulls. Once free of the support vessel, the sub cruised along the surface to a position whose coordinates had been recorded into the navigation system, and Austin put the Seamobile into a dive. The clear lake waters enveloped the cockpit bubble as the submersible sank into the lake, and within minutes they were following the line of megaliths to the tomb. Austin stopped the submersible at the entrance, made sure the vehicle's cameras were operating, and then goosed the horizontal thrusters. A second later, the vehicle slipped through the opening into the ancient sepulchre. The powerful lights failed to reach the far wall of the chamber, indicating that it was huge, with ceilings so high they couldn't be seen. As the Seamobile slowly made its way into the chamber, Austin panned the sub's movable light along the right wall and saw that it was decorated with a carved bas-relief. The skillfully executed and detailed renderings showed sailboats, houses, dancers, pastoral scenes with palm trees and flowers, dancers and musicians. There were flying fish and frolicking dolphins. The boats looked quite ancient. The people depicted were well-dressed and seemed to be enjoying a prosperous life. Skye leaned forward in her seat, her face pressed against the plastic bubble like a child at Christmas.
"I see wonderful things," she said, quoting Howard Carter's first words at the discovery of King Tut's tomb.
Austin had been thinking that there was something hauntingly familiar about the scenes.
"I've been here before," he said.
"Here? In this tomb?"
"No, but I've seen drawings similar to these carvings in a cave in the Faroe Islands in the North Atlantic. The style and subject was very much the same.
What do you make of them?"
"I'm probably foolish for guessing, but they look Minoan, similar to the drawings excavated at Akrotiri, on the island of Santorini, or in Crete. The Minoan civilization flourished around 1500 BC.
The significance of what she was saying dawned on her. "Do you know what this means?" she said with excitement. "These drawings and the ones you saw would indicate that the Minoans went much further afield than most people suspect."
"Which makes them the missing link in your international trade theory?"
"That's right," she said. "This confirms that East-West trade is far older and more extensive than anyone thought it was."
She clapped her hands.
"I can't wait to show this video to my smug-faced colleagues back in Paris."
The submersible came to the end of the wall, turned a corner, and started down another side of the rectangular chamber. The scenes were of Lac de Dormieux and the glacier. But instead of barren shore, there were buildings, even what appeared to be a rendering of the temple, complete with arches, and the glacier, as silent and implacable as ever.
"It appears you were right about settlements around the lakeshore and the mouth of the river."
"This is marvelous. We can use these carvings to make site maps of ruin locations."
In the sculpted scene, the ice field had covered even more of the valley centuries before when it was carved by some unknown artist. The sculptor had managed to imbue his work with a majesty and power that went beyond a mere objective rendering of what he saw. They made several sweeps of the chamber and found no markers or a sarcophagus.
"I was all wrong about this place," she said. "It's not a tomb. It's a temple."
"A reasonable assumption, given the lack of bodies. If we're done here, I'd like to unravel another lake mystery." He unfolded the side-scan sonar printout he'd brought with him and pointed at the anomaly on the lake's bottom.
"It looks like a plane," Skye said. "What's a plane doing down here?" "Wait. The man in the ice?"
Austin answered with an enigmatic smile. The sub's horizontal thrusters whirred, and they whisked through the temple door back out into the lake. He slowed the sub when they neared the position designated on the printout and kept his eyes peeled. Before long, a cigar-shaped object came into view. As they drew closer, he saw that the cylindrical wood framework was partially covered with tattered and faded red fabric. The conical engine housing had been torn off and lay on the bottom, and the engine gleamed in the sub's lights. The cold lake temperatures had kept the fuselage clear of marine vegetation that would have covered it in warmer climes. The propeller was gone, probably snapped off in the crash. He circled around the fuselage and found what was left of the missing wing several yards away. Then he brought the sub back to the plane and nosed close to the tail. Skye pointed.
"I saw that same design, the triple-headed eagle on the helmet that was found under the glacier."
"Too bad we don't have the helmet now."
"But we do. I brought it out with me. It's on the ship."
Austin remembered Skye clutching a bag as she climbed aboard the Seamobile. He was learning quickly that this attractive woman with the smile like a sunny day was not someone to be underestimated. Austin stared at the eagle, and then let his gaze shift to the empty cockpit. Now we know where the Iceman came from. He must have bailed out and his plane crashed in the lake. Skye responded with an evil laugh.
"I was thinking of Raynaud. He said that the Iceman didn't just drop out of the sky."
"He was wrong.
From what you've found, that's exactly what happened."
The submersible circled the wreck, with Austin shooting video and still photos of the wings and surrounding bottom, and then headed for the surface. Before long, they were stepping out of the cockpit onto the deck. Skye had been babbling with excitement about their find, but she went silent when she caught a glimpse of the glacier. She walked over to the rail and stared off at the ice field. Sensing her change in mood, Austin put his arm around her shoulders.
"Are you all right?"
"It was so peaceful underwater. Then we surfaced, and I saw the glacier."
She shuddered.
"It reminded me that I almost died under that thing."
Austin studied the troubled expression in Skye's lovely eyes, which were fixed in the 100-yard stare that shell-shocked troops sometimes get.
"I'm not a shrink, but I've always found it helpful to confront my demons," he said.
"Let's go for a boat ride." The unexpected suggestion seemed to bring her back to reality.
"Are you serious?" Grab a couple of bagels and a thermos of coffee from the mess, and I'll meet you at the skiff. I like my bagels with raisins, by the way. Skye was skeptical, but she had come to have a great deal of confidence in Austin, and would probably have followed him to the moon on a pogo stick if he asked. Austin got the power skiff ready while she rounded up coffee and bagels from the galley, and they set off for shore. They dodged floating chunks of ice and pulled the boat up at a dark gravel beach a few hundred yards from where the glacier narrowed and broke up in pieces as it encountered the lake. A short hike along the shore brought them to the glacier's sidewall. The icy bulwark rose several stories above the plain. Its surface was pockmarked with caves and craters and twisted free-form sculptures created by freezing, melting, and unimaginable pressures. The ice was covered with dirt, and a deep, unearthly blue light emanated from the wrinkles and grottos. "There's your demon," Austin said. "Now go up and touch it." Skye smiled wanly, approached the glacier as if it were alive, and reached out and touched an icy knob with a fingertip. Then she placed both palms on the glacier and leaned her weight against the ice, eyes closed, as if she were hoping to push it away. "It's cold," she said with a smile. "That's because your demon is nothing but a big ice cube. It's the same way I think about the sea. It's not out to get you. It doesn't even know you exist. You touched it. You're still breathing." He lifted the pack he'd been carrying. "Consultation is ended. Time for brunch." Near the edge of the lake, they found a couple of flat rocks to use as chairs and sat facing the water. Skye doled out the bagels and said, "Thanks for the exorcism. You were right about facing your fears." "I've had good experience in that area." She arched her brow. "Somehow, I don't see you being afraid of anything." "That's not true. I was very afraid that I would find you dead." "I appreciate that, and I owe you my life. But I meant it in a different way. You seem fearless when it comes to your own well-being." He leaned close to her ear and whispered, "Would you like to know my secret?" She nodded. "I put on one hell of a good act. How's your bagel?" "Fine. But my head is a whirl. What do you make of this craziness?" Austin stared off at the anchored Numa boat, thinking of Coleridge's description of a painted ship on a painted sea, and tried to put events in order. "Let's deal with what we know for starters." He sipped his coffee. "The scientists working the glacier find a man's body frozen in the ice, and apparently it has been there for some time. An old helmet and a strongbox are found near the body. A man posing as a reporter takes the box at gunpoint and floods the tunnel. Apparently, he knows nothing about the helmet." "That's where my logical mind bogs down. Why did he try to kill us? We were in no position to do him any harm. By the time we got out of the tunnel, he would have been long gone." "I think he flooded the tunnel to cover up the Iceman. You and the others happened to be in the way. Like the glacier. Nothing personal." She nibbled thoughtfully on her bagel. "That makes morbid sense, I suppose." Skye paused, her eyes going past Austin's shoulder. A cloud of dust was approaching at a high rate of speed. As the cloud neared, they could see that a Citroen was kicking up the dust. Fifi. The car skidded to a stop, and LeBlanc, Thurston, and Rawlins got out and came over. "I'm so glad we caught you," LeBlanc said, his broad face wreathed in a smile. "I called the ship from the power plant, and they said you had gone ashore." "We wanted to say goodbye," Thurston said. "You're leaving?" Skye said. "Yes," the glaciologist said, waving in the direction of the glacier. "There's no point in staying here with our observatory underwater. We're heading back to Paris. A helicopter will run us to the nearest airport."
"Paris," Skye said. "Do you have room for me?"
"Yes, of course," LeBlanc said. He extended his hand. "Thank you again for saving our lives, Monsieur Austin. I would not like Fifi to be an orphan. She will stay at the power plant with Monsieur Lessard. We are going to talk to the power company about draining the observatory. Perhaps we can return next season."
I'm so sorry to be running off like this, Skye said to Austin. But there's nothing more to be done here, and I want to compile all my data for analysis.
I understand. The Mummachug's project is coming to an end. I'll stay on board to write up my report while the ship's heading back up the river. Then I'll catch a ride to the nearest railroad station and take the high-speed train to Paris for our dinner date.
Bien. Under one condition. I'm buying.
How could anyone in his right mind refuse an enticing offer like that? You can show me the town.
I'd like that, she said. I'd like that very much.
Austin brought Skye back to the ship to collect her belongings and gave her a ride to the beach where the helicopter awaited. She kissed him on both cheeks and on the lips, made him promise to call when he got to Paris, and climbed into the helicopter. Austin was on his way across the lake when the chopper passed overhead and he saw Skye waving at him from a window. Back on board, Austin unloaded the video cassette and digital disc from the submersible's cameras. He took them into the ship's dry lab and fed the digital images into a computer. He ran off prints showing the design on the plane's fuselage and examined them. Next, he zeroed in on the photos he had taken of the plane's engine until he found the one he was looking for. It showed markings on the engine block. He selected the engraved area with his cursor, zoomed in, refining the image as he enlarged it, until he could see the name of the manufacturer and a serial number. He leaned back in his chair and stared at the image for a moment, and then he reached for a phone that could connect him anywhere in the world and punched out a number. Orville and Wilbur's flying bike shop, said a reedy voice. Austin smiled as he pictured the hawk nose and narrow face of the man at the other end of the line. You can't fool me, Ian. I happen to know that the Wright brothers closed their bicycle shop a long time ago. Hell, Kurt can't blame me for trying. I've been up to my earlobes trying to raise private funds for the Udvar-Hazy Center out at Dulles Airport, and I don't want to waste my time with small talk. Ian McDougall was a former Marine fighter pilot in charge of the Archives Division at the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum. He was the airborne equivalent of St. Julian Perlmutter, whose extensive library of nautical books was the envy of many academic institutions, and whose grasp of sea history was known the world round. The tall and lean McDougall was the physical antithesis of the rotund Perlmutter, and he was far less flamboyant, but his encyclopedic knowledge of aircraft and their history matched St. Julian's grasp of the sea. You can rely on me for a hefty contribution, Ian, and I'll try to spare the small talk, Austin said. I'm in France and I need to identify a plane I found at the bottom of a glacial lake in the Alps. I can always depend on you for a challenge. McDougall sounded delighted to be distracted from fundraising. Tell me about it. Crank up your computer and I'll send you some digital photos. Consider it cranked. Austin had already programmed the photos for transmission, and the pictures taken at the lake bottom whisked on cyber wings across the Atlantic in a millisecond. McDougall had stayed on the line, and Austin could hear him muttering to himself. Well, Austin said after a few moments. I'm taking a guess, but from the distinctive cone-shaped engine housing, I'd say we're looking at a Morane Saulnier. She was a World War I mono-wing fighter plane based on a racing plane. The little buzzard could outfly and outmaneuver almost any other fighter aircraft of the day. The gun and propeller synchronization setup was truly revolutionary. One of the Allied planes crashed, unfortunately, and Fokker copied the system and improved upon it. There's a moral there somewhere. I'll let you deal with the moral complexities. Given what you know, do you have any idea how this plane got to the bottom of the lake?
Fell out of the sky, obviously. Which is what planes sometimes do.
I can guess on the rest, but I'd probably be wrong. I do know someone who might be able to help you. It's only a couple of hours from Paris.
Austin jotted down the information. Thanks, he said. I'll get my museum contribution to you as soon as I get back to Washington. In the meantime, give my regards to Wilbur and Orville.
I'll be glad to oblige.
Austin hung up, and a moment later he was calling the number Ian had given him.